chance to make it up if I don't get it in tonight, because it's the end. So, if you look at the questions on page 149 and 150, I'm not going to go through every question, but I want to look at the thought question. In Isaiah 65, 17 and 66, 22, the Lord promised new heavens and a new earth. Where is this referred to in the New Testament, and what does it mean?
It's in Revelation 21, and I believe verse 22.
One to two.
21, 1 to 2.
Okay.
Did I write it down wrong? It's the hope of the church is what I the hope that we have through the church, the hope that we have through Jesus, and how it plays out in the end, and that is forever and ever.
Okay. Any other place in the New Testament?
Second Peter 3,
verse 13. So a couple places where the same figure is used. And that's really our text for tonight. It's talking about the new heavens and the new earth. As we went through chapters 63 through 65, we saw the Lord in judgment. And we saw him in judgment against Edom. We talked about Edom being symbolic of Israel's enemies. Judgment begins at the house of God. What shall be of those that are outside? So here the judgment begins at the very house of Jacob and Esau, her brothers, so Isaac's household. And so Edom is symbolic of all of the enemies of Israel. And then we talk about the mercy of the Lord and a charge and a plea. And the charge was a difficult one, and we saw God's answer that man is accountable to God. God did not make him where he could not respond. And God's answer is he will not utterly destroy Israel for his name's sake. It'll be like a little bit of new wine left in a cluster of grapes, and he will not destroy it all for the sake of that. And so there will be a faithful remnant. But in the context, others, that is non-Jews, will join the faithful remnant as servants of God and will be called by a new name. That's the context in which we enter into a discussion of the new heavens and the new earth. In the context, chapter 65 is talking about the coming in of the Gentiles. And really, if you go back to Romans chapter 9, through the end of the chapter, middle through the end of the chapter, and then Romans chapter 10, you'll see a discussion of the Gentiles coming in. And then in chapter 10, he asks the question, has Israel been cast away? We've talked about the coming in of the Gentiles and a covenant relationship with God is always associated with Messiah. So that's the context. Coming in of the Gentiles, times of Messiah. When we get to chapter 65 at the end, in verse 25, we'll see this picture of the wolf and the lamb again. We saw it in chapter 11. We're going to see it again here. And he talks about there will be no harm in all my holy mountain. And again, we saw from Isaiah 11, times of Messiah. So bracketed in between times of Messiah, we have this new heavens and a new earth, and an infant dies at 100 years old. So what does that mean? Well, the context is times of Messiah. So these are pictures of times of Messiah. There's a temptation to pull these out and make them stand alone and take them literally, but is the wolf and lamb to be understood literally? Chapter 11 is pretty plain. It's a picture of the times of Messiah. Wolf and the lamb, it's descriptive of peace. There shall be peace on all my holy mountain. Figurative. So there's a lot that we know is figurative. The middle there is going to be figurative too. Some anchor points. Go back to Isaiah chapter 2, talking about the mountain of the Lord's house. It shall come to pass in the latter days, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, and all nations shall flow to it. Hebrews 1 tells us that in these last days, God's Son has been appointed heir of all things. And Romans 1:5 tells us that concerning that Son, Jesus Christ, He is declared to be the Son of God with power, and it's through him we've received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among the nations. Again, that same picture of God's holy mountain, times of Messiah, all nations tied up together. How did all nations come in? It's through Jesus Christ. So there's two keys to understanding. First is the bringing in of the Gentiles is under Jesus. Isaiah 11:10, when you go back and you look at that, it says specifically, he will stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him. Romans 15:8-12 says specifically, this was talking about the Gentiles coming in. It quotes this place in Isaiah. So we know from New Testament inspired apostolic writing, Gentiles coming in under Messiah. The figure in Isaiah is pretty clear. In fact, in chapter 49 and verse 6, the writer says, it's too small a thing for my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob. I will give you as a light to the Gentiles. Does the New Testament have anything to say about the Gentiles coming in? Well, absolutely. Ephesians chapter 2 talks about Jesus being our peace. The middle wall of partition between Jew and Gentile is taken away. What was that middle wall of partition? It was the law of Moses. When was the law of Moses taken away? The death of Christ. So, Old Testament, New Testament, multiple places coming in as Gentiles associated with Messiah. It happened when Jesus died. Coming in as Gentiles is under Messiah. The wolf and the lamb is also under Jesus as Messiah. Chapter 11, verse 1 said, there shall be a rod coming from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Literally? No. It's a figure, just like many of the other things. He shall have a sword coming out of his mouth. Not literal, it's figurative. A lot of this is figurative. Same chapter, verse 6, just a little bit later, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb. And then verse 10, the root of Jesse shall stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him. Romans 8:15 again tells us plainly, times of Messiah is when the Gentiles will come in. And that's the picture of the wolf with the lamb is times of Messiah. So our text for tonight, when we talk about the new heavens and new earth, it's bracketed by these passages. We just absolutely know he's talking about times of Messiah. So the new heavens and new earth is a picture of times of Messiah. A little bit of background thinking. Psalm 104 talks about how great the Lord is, and the earth is full of your possessions. You've made all things. These wait for you. You open your hand, these things are filled with good. You hide your face and they are troubled. You take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. You send forth your spirit and they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. Literally? No. But when God comes in judgment, nations change. A new order. And so when we talk about new heavens and new earth, I believe he's saying specifically a new order or a new system of rule. The heavens, the sun, moon, and stars. In the beginning, we were told that they rule. The sun rules over the daytime. The moon and the stars rule over the night. Joseph had a dream. And he dreamed, and he told his brethren and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream, and behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and his brethren, and his mother, father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you dream? Shall I, my mother, and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to you and the earth? Father and the mother are rulers in the household. System of rule. And so this dream of the heavens really is a dream of a system of rule. In Isaiah 14, we saw this picture of the king of Babylon. And he's saying in his heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. What does it mean for him to be up in the heavens? To rule. The rule of mankind. In Isaiah 34, the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down. What is that picture? Well, when the host of heaven is rolled up like a scroll, the system of rules that exists is going to be closed like a book. God's going to make a change. Why? Because of judgment. So when he says his sword shall be bathed in heaven, what does he mean? Those that rule will be judged. God will cast them out. Former system of rule, law of Moses. Jeremiah 3. It shall come to pass when you are multiplied and increased in the land. In those days, says the Lord, they shall say no more of the Ark of the Covenant. Well, wait just a minute. Law of Moses, the Ark of the Covenant was a tremendous thing. It's a symbol. He says, it's not even going to come to mind. Why not? It's going to be a change of system of rule. The law of Moses will mean nothing. At that time, Jeremiah 3:17, the very next verse, at that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all nations shall be gathered into it. There will be a change in rule, and it's associated with the coming in of all nations. Isn't it interesting how closely that picture matches just what Isaiah's been saying? Same author. God. What does he say? Same kind of language. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. Same language Jeremiah used. Why? A new system of rule. So the context is the law of Moses versus the law of Christ. The new heavens, the former will not be remembered. The Mosaic law symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant is ended. In these times, the wolf and the lamb shall feed together. Same picture as in chapter 11. And in that day, there shall be a root of Jesse. Same things we've already talked about. Okay. So, get into the text. Start reading in verse 17. Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. The former shall not be remembered or come to mind. Remember the context. He's just said that there's a difference between the Jewish nation and his servants. The Jewish nation, those that rejected God, will be cursed. But the faithful remnant would be blessed. Remember he made the distinction, behold, my servant shall eat, but you shall be hungry. My servant shall drink, but you shall be thirsty. And in verse 15, you shall leave your name as a curse to my chosen. The Lord will slay you and call his servants by another name. And that new name is associated with the new heavens and the new earth. And he says, be glad and rejoice forever, verse 18, in which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem as a rejoicing, and her people as a joy. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and the joy of my people. The voice of weeping will no longer be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. Reminds you of that song that we sing, No Tears in Heaven, right? Wait. Doesn't the text say that God will wipe away every tear? How can he wipe away a tear if it's not a cry? You see, we focus on that no tears. The focus is really on comfort. The focus, I believe, is really on comfort. Isaiah 22 says, it's a day of trouble and of treading down. He's talking about the day of the Lord. And in that day, there will be a call to weeping. Why? Because of judgment. And so if there's no weeping, I think it's associated with no judgment. A close walk with God with no judgment. He says in chapter 54, for this is like the waters of Noah to me when they had gone into Babylonian captivity and come back. He says, in the future my kindness shall not depart from you, nor shall my covenant peace be removed. So no weeping, no judgment, like they had been through. It would be a time of close walking with God. Okay. That's my take on it. Maybe a bit controversial. Some others may see something different there. But it's a time of restoration. When we get to the next few verses, verse 20, no more shall an infant from there live a few days, nor an old man who has not fulfilled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. The next few verses talks about they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. So you see kind of two pictures here. First picture is clearly of long age. If a child dies, he'll be 100 years old, not just a few days old. So if a child dies at 100 years old, how long will the old man be alive? A long, long time. The second picture you see is a picture of assurance. They shall build houses and inhabit them, plant vineyards, eat their fruit. They shall not build another inhabit. Assurance of blessings. Now, when we talk about these, this picture of long life, what does that remind you of? I mean, for this picture to be relevant to us, it's got to be a picture we're somewhat familiar with, right? You can't make an analogy unless you understand the thing that you're describing. If you say something is like this, or if you say it is that, it's a metaphor or a simile, you have to understand the thing that you're saying it's like or is, right? So when you see this picture, what does that bring to mind?
I may have missed it completely, but I think, or to me, what he's talking about there is peace. Regardless of how long you live, whether it is a short life or a long life, you will live in peace if you're with me.
Certainly, and peace is part of it.
Spiritual, that is a spiritual peace, not a worldly peace.
It kind of reminds me of when Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And so that's spiritual longevity.
Okay. That's eternal life. And I'm not sure he's really broached that subject here. I mean, it's relevant. But I'm thinking of something else. I'm wondering if you've seen the connection. Has there ever been a time when men lived on Earth to be 1,000 years old?
Yeah, pretty close to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait. This is a picture we're familiar with. Mm-hmm. Well, when was that? It was a long time ago, wasn't it? Let me kind of skip ahead. I don't like the way my slides are coming out, even though I set them up that way. If you go back to the early part of creation, we saw lifespans that were up close to 1,000 years, right? What do we know about that time period? Because this seems like it's similar to the picture he's giving us. Men living really long. So if men are living to be 900 years, 100 years would be like a child, right? Mm-hmm. What's this a picture of?
I'm thinking it's heaven, because whether you die as a baby or you die as an old person, you're going to be with God. And that's the picture that I get out of that verse.
Is there going to be death in heaven, though?
No, but you will have already died. This is how I think of it. You'll have already died and go to heaven with God, so that whether you die as a baby or you die as an old adult, that you're going to be with him and you're going to have that peace.
Okay. I mean, those things are true. I'm just not sure that's the picture he's painting here. Okay. Here he's painting a picture that, yes, men are still going to die, but we're talking about long days. I don't think it's literal. I don't think he's saying in the blessed Messiah age, we're all going to live to be 1,000 years old. I don't think it's what he... But he's painting a picture that's remarkably like something that's happened in the past. And I think what he's saying is it's going to be like that in some way. Well, in what way will it be like that? Well, here's something to think about. Back when men lived to be that old, and women too, was a time of closer walking with God. The Father spoke with God. God spoke to the fathers. Why did that change? Well, if you look at the ages after the flood, they drop remarkably. If you look at the ages after Babylon, they drop remarkably. If you look at the ages after Sodom, they drop remarkably. All these are judgments. So this time of blessed long life is before these great judgments.
Could I ask you a question, David?
Sure.
Do you think that that will actually happen on earth?
Well, remember the beginning, the bracketing is times of Messiah, times of Messiah. This period of long life is represented as a picture of times during Messiah. So yes, I believe this picture is applicable to times of Messiah. Well, what was significant about the long age? It's a time of closer walking with God. It's a time before judgments. I think that's enough of a picture. He's saying, what's it going to be like under Messiah? It's going to be a closer walk with God. It's going to be a restoration back to the times when men walked closer with God before these great judgments. I think that's all he's really saying. What do we talk about when we talk about Jesus coming? We talk about dealing with the sin problem. Why is that such a big deal? Because sin separated us from God. The law of sin and death. But what does that do? That puts us back, walking closer with God, restoring the relationship that Adam had in the garden. Right? So these pictures continually push backwards to when man walked closer with God. That's what it's going to be like during the time of Messiah. The long age is simply a figure to draw you to that idea. When men walk closer with God. Remember, he's creating Jerusalem as a joy and a rejoicing. Why? Because it will be a time of righteousness. Righteousness looks back before these great judgments. Well, what about the building houses and inhabiting, planting vineyards and eating their fruit?
That reminds me of where he tells us to lay up and store our treasures in heaven where moth doesn't eat up. So if you build up your treasures in heaven, that you get to keep those. No one can take that from you.
Okay, and those things are certainly true, but we're thinking of heaven, and I'm saying, look, the text is bracketed by times of Messiah, what's in the middle? Times of Messiah.
Well, that's what...
How does this picture
relate
to times
of the Messiah when you're doing that?
But we're laying up treasure there. We're not eating of them.
We're building them right now.
You will eat of them and not another.
But we're building them right now.
But he's saying you will eat of them and not another. That's not storing up. That's enjoying. You're talking about storing up something you will enjoy in the future. He's talking about enjoying something now and not given to another. The picture is pretty plain. You think back of, well, when was it that Israel sowed and tried to harvest and somebody else took it. When was that?
Many times.
Okay, think of one.
Gideon,
yes.
Gideon. Now, what was the problem with the times of Gideon?
They were being raided.
Why?
They would build their own houses and they would grow their own crops, and then when the time of the season came for reaping, the enemies would come in and take everything.
But
why?
There's
judgment.
But why?
Because they sinned.
Okay, there's the key. So here you've got a picture of, hey, this is the way it's been in the past. You sowed and you reaped and somebody else took it. Why? Because you were not walking with God. You had rejected him. Here's a picture of you're going to plant, you're going to sow, and you're going to reap, and you're going to have. Why? Because you're walking with God. Isn't it remarkable how both of these two pictures, the longevity of age and the assurance, both tie into times of Messiah as a closer walk with God? Those are the pictures. Now, I don't think we need to get into details and talk about what does planting mean, what do houses mean. These are pictures, not intended to be picked apart. You want to see the broad message. And the broad message is the blessedness of walking with God. That's what it's going to be like in times of Messiah. There's going to be this blessedness of walking with God. Restoration of things to what they used to be. And so, in verse 24, it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. What's it been like up to now? In talking about their rejecting God? God says, because of your actions, I will hide my face from you. No answer from God. They sought me, but I wouldn't listen to them. Why? Because they rejected me. But in the times of the blessedness of walking with God, before they call, I'm there to answer. Why? Because there's this close walk with God. That same picture, while they are still speaking, I hear. That same picture, the wolf and the lamb will feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, the dust shall be the serpent's food. And that's a picture taken from chapter 11, where you've got these things that are natural enemies. Wolf and the lamb, child and the spider, the lion and the ox. Natural enemies will be in peace. Where? God's holy mountain. What's God's holy mountain like? Chapter 2, place where all nations come to God. That's a picture of the Messianic kingdom. When those that are Jew and Gentiles, by nature, national enemies, national boundaries get put aside, we're one in Christ. Think of any ethnic differences in this world, whether it's by color, by heritage, whatever it may be. We may seem to be enemies in the earth. Well, guess what? In God's holy mountain, there's no difference. There's no male, there's no female, there's no Jew, there's no Gentile. We're all one. Natural enemies are made to be in peace. That's the picture of the Messianic kingdom. And I say to you, that's here now. That's here now. Well, is that the end of the picture? We look at tears, the voice of weeping will be heard no more in her. Revelation, we get in Job, God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. We see this picture of light in Isaiah 60, verse 19. The sun will no longer be your light by day. In Revelation 21, the city had no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it. And then 2 Peter says, in talking about the righteousness of God's kingdom, says, nevertheless, we according to his promise look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Which promise? Where was it that God promised a new heavens and a new earth for us to look forward to? If this is all messianic, it's happened, right? So why does Peter talk about a promise of God for a new heavens and a new earth? Where's the promise? Which promise?
Revelation.
Well, Revelation, if you understand many of the commentators, they believe Revelation was written after 2 Peter. Where's the promise? Is it possible that just as the Hebrew writer would write in chapter 3 and talk about we've become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end, while it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Now that was said in the Psalms after Joshua had given them rest. And God did give them rest from their enemies all around. But the writer argues, because of what the psalmist said, we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Therefore, a promise remains of entering his rest. Let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterwards have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God. The idea being that, yes, God promised a rest, and yes, a rest was given, but was that all God cared about? No, there's a picture in the scriptures of a rest that's beyond the rest that Joshua had. And so the question that we have to ask is it possible that this statement of the voice of weeping will no longer be heard in her. Did I put that two places? Wow. Okay. Is it possible that these things that we've seen in Isaiah are fulfilled in the Messianic kingdom, but that's not the end of it? That the picture that God has for his nation extends far out as long as time endures. And the picture is not complete. Yes, the key aspects are there. But is the church fulfilled everything that God has in mind for her? I don't believe it has. I believe God urges us to look forward to the fullness of this picture. And the fullness of the picture extends on beyond. So this new heavens and new earth, new system of rule, yes, it's here in days of Messiah, and these things are fulfilled, but not completely. There is yet more that God will do with his people. And so we, according to the promise, look for that picture to be ultimately fulfilled. And the promise remains of new heavens and new earth. We talk about the spiritual kingdom, or the heavenly kingdom. Where is the heavenly kingdom? It's in heaven. Is that a new system of rule? Well, yeah, when this earth is done away with, that'll be the end. When the last enemy is conquered, the last enemy is death, and Christ hands the kingdom over to the Father. Yes, it's a new order. And yes, God looks for his people to fulfill his picture on into heaven. I believe that's really ultimately the idea. Well, okay, that doesn't give me much time for 66. Any questions on 65? 66. We've got this interesting statement. Let me blank this for just a moment. First few verses. God says, heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build for me? And where is the place of my rest? Those are kind of statements that Solomon made when the temple was built. Thinking back and looking back to the glory of Solomon's temple while time of captivity in Babylon, when everything's been destroyed, and thinking all that is gone, think about it. All these things my hand made, all those things exist. Is that important? But on this will I look. On him who is poor and of contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. What's important? Is the temple important? God says, no, what's important is the one who has a contrite spirit. The one who trembles at my word. And then he launches into the statement. It's kind of difficult sentence structure. He who kills a bull if he slays a man. He who sacrifices a lamb as if he breaks a dog's neck. He who offers a grain offering as if he offers swine blood. He who offers incense as if he blesses an idol. In each of those couplets, the first one is a valid action under the old law. To offer a bull, it's a sin or peace offering. Sacrifice a lamb for a sin or peace offering. To offer an oblation for vows and freewill offerings. To burn incense reserved for the sons of Aaron. All those things are valid. But the idea is, if you present an ox with the same spirit as if you murdered a man, or you presented a lamb with the same spirit as if you tried to present a dog, which, by the way, the price of a dog is not acceptable for any vow. It's an abomination before God. Any of these things with the wrong attitude, condemned. Why? Well, if God desires a man that trembles at his word and has a contrite spirit, he demands not just physical obedience, but obedience from the heart. It's what's been emphasized all along. So, verse 4, I will choose their delusions, I will bring their fears on them, because when I called, no one answered. You ever wonder what you're going to answer when you get to heaven, you stand before the judgment throne, and you think, well, God, I was there on Sundays, you know, I did this and I did that. God says, you know, I called you and I wanted you to do something for me and you didn't answer. Probably not one we thought about much. When God calls, are we ready? But they did evil before my eyes and chose that in which I did not delight. And we think about doing things and we think about, well, God didn't say not to. It's not an abomination before God, but is it something God delights in? So we think we can follow horoscopes and get involved in tarot cards and, you know, God didn't say don't, you know, do this or that. Well, we know that God does not delight in those things. So are we thinking about what God delights in? Hear the word of the Lord, you who tremble at his word, your brethren who hated you, who cast you out for my name's sake. They said, let the Lord be glorified that we may see your joy, which sounds good, but it's probably said in sarcasm because he says, they shall be ashamed. And so there's a sound of noise from the city, a voice from the temple, the voice of the Lord who fully repays his enemies. Before she travailed, she gave birth. Before her pain came, she delivered a male child. Who has heard of such a thing? Well, if you've been in Robert's Revelation class, you've seen this same figure in Revelation chapter 12, the male child, the Messiah. First fruits of the nation. And so he talks about in verse 8, shall a nation be born at once? Remember he'd given the picture earlier of the desolate woman who would have to enlarge her tents because there's no room for the children, and she would say, where did these children come from? Yes, Israel is giving birth to the Messiah and a spiritual nation. Shall I come bring to the time of birth and not cause delivery? Shall I who cause delivery shut up the womb? And the answer is absolutely not. God has purposed it. He has planned it. It will happen. And it will be a time of rejoicing. And so he says in verse 12, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream. When peace like a river attendeth my way. It's a song we sing, right? Okay. You will be fed. You will be comforted. Verse 13, as one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you. We often think of God as in a fatherly position. Here he's described in a motherly position, position of comforting his people. Now when you see this, your heart's going to rejoice, your bones shall flourish like grass. The hand of the Lord shall be known to his servants, and his indignation to his enemies. Behold, the Lord will come with fire and with chariots and a whirlwind. He will render his anger with fury and rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword the Lord will judge all flesh. And the slain of the Lord will be many. So it's going to come a time of judgment. Servants of God will be with him and will be comforted. Those that reject him, they will face retribution from God, his anger. And so he says in verse 18, I know their works and their thoughts. It shall be that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. I will set a sign among them, and those among them who escape I will send to the nations. God's people will go forth as witnesses, scattered through the nations, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. Why is that important? Because all nations will come into the mountain of the Lord's house. And they shall bring all your brethren for an offering to the Lord out of all nations, horses and chariots and mules and so forth. Where? To my holy mountain, Jerusalem. Same picture we had in the beginning in chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. And I will take some of them for priests and Levites. Mark it down. I don't have time to go into it, but Jeremiah 33:18. We think of the sure mercies of David, where he says, he will never lack a man to sit on the throne, but he gives a promise to Aaron that he will never have a lack of a man to stand before me and offer sacrifices. Just as the sure mercies of David are fulfilled in the church, so the priesthood promise is fulfilled in the church. Jeremiah 33:18. For as the new heavens and the new earth which I shall make will remain before me, shall your descendants and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that when one new moon to another, one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me. That's the heritage of those that follow God. The blessings, and they will constantly walk with God, and they will worship him. What about those that are without? Verse 24. They shall go forth and look upon the corpse of the man who have transgressed against me, for their worm does not die, and their fire is not quenched. The picture is, body is thrown into an open pit, it will be eaten with worms. Their worms, that is, that which consumes them, doesn't die. Just that continual consumption. It's an ugly picture, isn't it? Same picture as their fire doesn't go out. And what he's saying is their judgment doesn't change. It will be an eternal judgment. What does that remind you of? The New Testament passage, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Where at?
Mark
9:44. I think that was one of the research questions for the for this chapter. Description of Gehenna, right? Jesus used that to describe hell. So, there will be a place of destruction for those that reject God, a place of comfort for those that follow him. That's the picture. And it's entirely consistent all the way through with all the other pictures that we've seen. Comments or questions before we're done? Probably gave you some new thoughts tonight, new things to think about. it's easy for us to look at new heavens, new earth, and say that's entirely under times of Messiah. But when do times of Messiah end? They never end. I mean, if there is an end, it's when Jesus turns the kingdom over to the Father. When is that? That's after judgment. That's in heaven. So this picture is not complete. Yes, it's a picture of times of Messiah, but it goes out into the future. But the picture doesn't change. I know many people look at the scriptures and say, oh, well, this is something new for the future. No. It's the same picture now and in the future forever. This is what God has planned for the church. Like the waters of Noah, the church will not be cut off. The church will not go into Babylonian captivity. The church will walk with God and enjoy the blessings of walking with God. When they call, I will answer. It's a tremendous comfort. Beautiful picture. We got done. Thank you for your time.